Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the extra credit edition of Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We're doing this episode via Google Meet. And apparently we wore the same shirt, so I guess we're off to a softball game after this episode is over.
That's right. It's going to be the Hula Hoops Manufacturing Podcast.
We're taking them on, finally.
Those guys are good. They're good.
They talk a lot of trash, and I think it's about time they had a reckoning.
Yeah, we'll show them. This episode is for our scholars, our searchers, our saviors, our patrons.
Our patrons and our matrons. I was just saying the other day, what would Strange Studies of Strange Stories be without our matrons, you know? To which the bus driver replied, I don't know you. Please sit down. Don't know what you're talking about. Patrons and matrons can listen to this episode on their exclusive RSS feed or watch it on YouTube. The link is in your show notes.
Yes. This is our unedited live show for April. And since we're doing stories from the Future of Female anthology all month, we thought maybe we should watch a science fiction film that it's directed by a woman.
Yeah. And I started looking through all the listicles that inevitably pop up. If you search on this topic, Wonder Woman is on all of them. Yeah. But we were looking for something more obscure that we didn't know. There were other slick, bigger budget movies like The Old Guard on Netflix. Did you see that one?
No.
With Charlize Theron. She runs team of immortal assassins.
All right. I wanted to see that, but I never got around to it.
I didn't either. I'm going to have to check that one out. Strange Days was on a couple of lists.
Oh, that's Catherine Bigelow. I knew that.
Yeah. I didn't realize that she was the one that directed that. Mm-hmm. She was the first woman. She won the best director for the sequel to Near Dark, Zero Dark Thirty. which is pretty impressive.
Wow.
She was the first woman to win the Oscar. Since then, we've had Chloe Zhao, who won for Nomadland, and who is making a vampire movie, as we reported on our last bonus episode. And Jane Campion won an Oscar for The Power of the Dog, which I assume is a werewolf movie.
Must be.
See it. I found two films buried on these listicles that sounded interesting. The first was an African film called Atlantics, and the second was a Polish film called The Lure.
Yeah.
I watched Atlantics, and I really loved it, although it was a ghost story, and somewhat typical in the ghost story. It was an atypical film, but I was hungry for something maybe a little stranger, and so I said, let's do The Lure, I think, because it was a little more on brand for us. It's like an evil mermaid deal. You watched it first and said, I don't know what to make of this.
Yeah.
Which was exciting.
Yeah.
So we could talk about Atlantics in a bit, but let's mostly talk about The Lure. And then there was another film that just came up this morning that I thought, well, we can talk a little about this as well. It's a documentary we both really loved, called Bathtubs Over Broadway. And I can make a case for that being relevant. But let's start with The Lure.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's actually sci-fi or fantasy or something else totally outside of that, but it's called The Lure. It came out in 2015. It's directed by, this is a Polish name that I'm probably pronouncing wrong, but I'm going to give it a try. Agnieszka Smoczyńska.
I'd say Agnieszka Smoczyńska.
Smoczyńska.
I'm gonna sure go with what she's listening to this podcast and just like these guys. I'm going to go ahead and keep listening.
Trent Winkle, a reviewer, said The Lure is a Polish electropunk mermaid sex horror musical with heart. And I thought, okay, yeah, that's a pretty good way to describe this movie. It's fairly unclassifiable because it's not. I mean, there's parts that are funny. There's definitely parts that are horrible. There are things that make you uncomfortable. I don't know.
I think that's a great way to classify the movie as well. You said a reviewer, Trent Winkle.
Yeah.
But in your notes, it just said Trent Winkle said The Lure is a Polish electropunk film. And I was like, who's Trent Winkle? That's the mystery to me.
He's a film because I went after I saw it. I read reviews about what had thought. Generally, really positive. People, at least film reviewers, love this movie. It's all in Polish with English subtitles. All the music has subtitles as well, and a lot of it is pretty out there. I'm not sure if the strangeness comes from my lack of knowledge about Polish culture or if it's really just strange. Even a Polish person would see this and go, oh man, this movie's out there.
That question as well. And I wondered, you know, I don't mean this in a bad way, but the lyrics kind of felt like bad lip reading.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were that random, you know, the bad lip reading.
Yeah,
YouTube
videos.
Yeah,
but I know them. Yeah, yeah, I love those guys.
I have to say, I liked the music. The crazy lyrics really were part of the reason I liked the movie, because if they were relevant to what was happening in the story, it was obscure to me. You know, yeah. Like sometimes I thought, why is she saying these things? What does it have to do with the situation? Musicals can be so dumb because somebody will break out in song over something that you're watching right in front of you. But this was hard to decode. Yeah. And I think it might have been making fun of itself in a way that I couldn't totally grasp. If I were doing genre freeze at an improv show and somebody suggested Eastern European musical, I might say some of the things that were in these songs, you know, like we are all depressed, everything is terrible, the egg is in the window. I don't know. That's what all the songs felt like. But I had this memory.
They did. Yeah, yeah. No, I just felt the same thing where maybe the egg is in the window. Not that that was actually in there, but there were things like that. I go, maybe that's a common phrase in Poland that I'm just not that has its own meaning and its own history and its own context that I'm just not privy to.
Exactly. I had this memory watching the film of us going to Slam Dance back in 2006 for the Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
The Lovecraft Historical Society was gracious enough to invite the cast and crew, so we were able to go. It was fun. The movie played with a short film called The Devil. I don't know if you remember it.
No, I don't.
Because Call of Cthulhu was 45 minutes, and so there was this 40-minute short, Diabol, in Polish. The director was Tomasz Szafranski. Mm-hmm. It was really good. I looked him up, and since then he's gone on to have a very good career in Polish media.
Oh, wow.
He's directed a ton of television and film. Festival, talking to him and some of the other filmmakers. Now, obviously it was difficult. They knew some English. I don't know any Polish because I'm an American. No. Don't know those things, but we were able to communicate about this and that, and they were, you know, I was asking, is this representative of what people see in Poland? Because it was a really challenging, interesting movie. And he said, no, everything in Poland right now is shiny, happy musical shows. Who wants to be the next pop star, American Idol kind of things. Challenging ideas, gritty stuff. This is not accepted in Polish media right now. It's everything is very got this nice, glossy, almost 1950s-esque veneer to it.
Mm.
Leans heavily musical. I don't know if that was just his opinion or if that was true or not.
Yeah.
But I thought maybe this movie was pushing back against that. That was part of the thing I wasn't getting.
Could be. Yeah, absolutely. Now, the premise of this movie is that these two mermaid sisters decide instead of eating some dudes that they're going to go hang out with them and perform in their band at a cabaret strip club, which seems to be communist era Poland, or at least it seemed like that to me.
I think that is what is strongly suggested. It starts with that mermaid POV coming up out of the water, and the band is on the shore. They just roll up on them and we're off to the story, which kind of reminded me of the Vampire Lestat a little bit. How he heard the 80s band playing, and that's what woke him up in New Orleans.
Yeah, the band consists of an older man as a drummer, a woman in her 40s, about, I'm guessing, as the main singer. They're a couple. There's this young, handsome bass player. There's also the skeezy club owner with the little pencil-thin mustache who introduces the mermaids is maybe like a potential act for the club. So that they
bring the mermaids by, what do you think, for this old man? Yeah.
Yeah.
The nightclub is really strange. It's mostly kind of older people, but just getting down hard, you know, everybody's smoking.
Yeah.
And shooting vodka, wearing really flashy clothing. I do think that it's, I guess it was the Polish People's Republic at that point. It was communist until 89.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now it's modern day Republic of Poland. It's pretty strange when they introduce the mermaids to the nightclub owner. You know, you just pour water over their legs. They have legs, but then they turn into mermaid tails.
Yeah, it's very unsettling, that whole scene, because the girls are, when they come in, they're just totally nude, but they have no vaginas or anus in their human form. So, like, they show their crotches, and there's just nothing there. They would say, like, a Barbie doll.
Yeah.
They got nothing going on, and then they pour water on their legs, and the girls are totally cool with this. They're like kind of smiling and a little flirty. It's all creepy. It's not sexy at all. It's really off-putting. but they don't seem to mind all of this, and they're kind of amused by this attention that they're getting. So when they put their the water on them, they get the fish tails, but also they have fish vaginas. Mm-hmm. And the club owner just comes over and he puts his finger in one of the girl's fish vaginas, like just kind of examining her, and she doesn't seem to care. She's like, yeah, check that out, buddy. You know, she's got that kind of expression on there.
If even that, it's really otherworldly. They're much more like fairies or demons or something like that. You know, these are not human creatures. So to them, this objectification means like nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
And you think, but yeah, when it comes in and they're all smooth, he's like, eh, and they go, no, wait, there's a vagina in the fish tail. Oh, now they're valuable. So there's definitely,
oh, right. that's what
scene's all about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now it's agreed that the girls are now part of the act. They're named Silver and Golden. Golden warns Silver not to fall in love with this young guy. So you know that she's going to. That'll happen. There's a lot of music in this. All the music, besides the Donna Summer cover that they have at the beginning, is written by Barbara and Zuzanna Worska of the Polish band Baladi or Baladi I Romanis. Again, it's strange stuff.
I think it's Zuzanna Ronska and the band is Baladi I Roman. Romance, like romance.
Oh, okay. Like a romance ballad, sure.
Why are we even trying?
I don't know. Again, it's strange stuff. It's not quite right to me. I don't know if it's intentional or if it's a cultural thing again, but it's very strange. All the music seems like a little off, and it gives me that off feeling, which the whole movie gives me that off feeling in a good way.
It definitely is not what you expect out of a musical. There's not big soaring choruses. It's not sing-songy at all. It's very, it can be repetitive at times, counter chorus, minor key. It kind of presents as a synthy Euro trash presentation of The Little Mermaid. That's what this is. Not really as you'd expect. And when I say The Little Mermaid, I really mean the fairy tale, not the Disney film. The movie that it reminded me, or a series of films that it reminded me of the most in terms of its feel, weirdly, are Nicholas Winding Refn's early movies Pusher 2 and Pusher 3, which he did Drive, is probably what he's mostly famous for.
Oh, right.
But his early movies, Pusher, which are kind of a Pulp Fiction reaction and really gritty, but there's a lot of clubs and strip clubs and older people wearing tracksuits in these strip clubs and stuff. And it definitely has the same feel, the sleazy Eastern European feel of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting too with these characters because they are predators. I mean, they eat men, but it feels like that they're being exploited. But then are they? Are they the ones doing the exploitation? Like I said, there's a lot of nudity and sexual things in this movie, but it really stresses that they're unhuman, and that unhumanness comes off creepy. Eventually, Silver, she does fall in love with this blonde bass player fella, but he won't have sex with her because of her fishy half. And, you know, she's like, have sex with my fish vagina, and he's like, no, I'm not doing that, because obviously he's very close-minded.
Close-minded, right. He says, you'll always be an animal to me. And I was like, well, good. He's got some state. I mean, yeah, we've talked about that before, that weird an animal. No, you know, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't remember in what context, but there was some story where we were talking about making out with a cat or something. What was that?
I don't remember.
We definitely have come up against this issue of hooking up with animals before.
Animal people. People, yeah, animals. Yeah. Not just a straight up animal. So Silver, she is in love with him, and she wants to have a transplant operation with another woman. They don't say who this other woman is that gets her fish tail.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, that was weird. But Golden warns her not to do this, and so does Triton, who in this movie is like in a metal band, and he had horns that he cut off. One he pulled out, and the other was broken off in a fight, so he's got these weird kind of Hellboy-like stumps on his head.
It's real gross.
It's pretty weird. And he says, look, if you do this, you're going to lose your voice. And if the guy runs off and marries another woman, you're going to just turn to seafoam, which I thought was very specific. He has to run off and marry another woman, not just hook up with another woman.
That's from the fairy tale.
Yeah. So Golden is not seduced by humans at all. She goes out and she kills and eats some dudes. She tries to warn her sister again. Well, they call each other sister, but I don't know if they're sister because they're pretty sexually charged in their interactions with one another.
Yeah, I think.
Well, I mean, there's a part where they're like making out in front of everybody when they're with the punk rockers and stuff. So,
but maybe they're doing that for show. Yeah,
it could be for show.
They're not still, humans.
They're not humans. She warns Silver again, like I said, repeatedly, but Silver says that she's in love with this guy, and then she's going to go through with the operation, which is very gory. They just kind of have her on a bed of ice, and this other girl on a bed of ice, they just cut her in half. There's a song that she's singing, like it's a musical number.
I know.
While it happens. What?
And then they never follow up with the other woman who got the fishtail.
No. It's very bizarre.
Yeah.
Now, over the next few minutes, if you don't want the ending spoiled, I'm going to wrap it up. If you think you might see this and you want to just see how it turns out, just skip over the next few minutes of the show. But the bass player basically, okay, time to pause. And now the bass player finds another woman almost immediately after this happens, leaves Silver. Silver is happy for him and decides that she doesn't want to eat him. She goes to the wedding, her and her sister both. And if she does eat him, Triton says, if you eat him, before the sun rises, you'll be fine. You'll turn back into a mermaid and live. But she decides that she would rather die and have him be happy than kill him and eat him. So they embrace. She turns to sea foam. Golden, however, her sister, is pissed and kills him immediately after her sister dies. And that's the end of the movie, which I thought was pretty cool. I like that.
I did too. It was all for nothing. But, that was the subversion of the fairy tale, which was really cool. And it's funny because just yesterday I also read The Bloody Chamber by Angela Carter, because it's been recommended a bunch and we're going to cover it on the show soon. And that is a subversion of Bluebeard's Bloody Chamber, the man who's killing his wives and keeping him in a... Mm-hmm. That it's got a similar ending. But this is essentially a retelling of The Little Mermaid, the fairy tale, as I keep saying, by Hans Christian Andersen. And in that story, she does have sisters, I think five of them, who keep, they get every year, one of them gets to visit the land. And so she hears these stories of what it's like up there. And she goes, falls in love with a human. And in that story, mermaids live about 300 years. Humans have human lifespans, but they have eternal souls because it's sort of a Christian world. And she wants to have a soul. She wants to live on the land and do all the earth things, but she also wants an immortal soul. She drinks a potion. It's basically the same deal as this film, the experiment in this film, or the
operation,
she can have the soul if the prince falls for her and marries her, but if he marries somebody else, she'll turn into seafoam. And he sort of gets tricked into an arranged marriage, does marry somebody else. Her sisters rise up with a dagger and tell her, if you kill him, and that element was in here as well.
Oh, okay.
You can be a mermaid again if you decide to kill him because he's marrying somebody else. But she says, you know what, I want him to be happy. Doesn't do it, turns to foam. Now, in the fairy tale, she gains a soul. Her ordeal allowed her. So when she turns to foam, it's like, oh, this blows. But then she's like, wait a minute, I'm in heaven. So it's sort of a...
Right.
Or she gets to use her lifetime to do... And there's a reward. There's like a third
path.
There's a
reward for it. Sure.
But so this one, it was just, no, there's no reward. She just turned to foam, and then the other sister comes in and gets it.
Yeah. Which I enjoyed. And Rachel did too. Now, I'm not really sure what the movie's thematically trying to say, or in what ways, if any, it is a feminist piece. I'm not sure.
The Little Mermaid is obviously a very pervasive myth and a very successful property for Disney, and coming out again. And, what's that all about? So it doesn't have all those elements that I'm talking about with the sisters, I don't think, really, in the sea foam. But it does have... I want to change myself to be in that world. Like, I want to be a part of something different.
Yeah.
Which inherently seems to me to be, have the germ of a feminist, this is something that we have to talk about. How do we change and alter ourselves so we can be appealing to the eyes of men, which I think is just a strong story to explore.
It doesn't. Yeah. That doesn't seem, obviously, that's anti-feminist. It's about how they can fit in with men and that. Actually, I found something written by Kate Hagen, here, and she talks about this movie, and she's written other feminist stuff as well. So I'm just going to read the couple paragraphs here.
Okay.
The lure updates a classic fantasy fairy tale by placing two sexually empowered women at the center of the story and letting them play with gorgeous gowns, idiot men who deserve to die, and every glorious color of the modern world. Making this story a musical once again, but infusing feminine horror elements into that world, creating a startling update to the traditional folktale. This creates a lack of security for the audience as we move between beautiful moments of reflection and gory deaths, sometimes within the course of a single song.
So true. Because narrative is comforting, right? And I didn't know where this was going.
I felt very uncomfortable through most of the movie, in a good way. How do you pronounce the director's name again?
Smosinska's take.
Yeah. On The Little Mermaid, understands that for women, beauty and violence are forever linked, and that the intersection of creation and destruction creates a constant internal battle for every woman alive. And the lure isn't afraid to engage with some of the more taboo parts of mermaid sexuality. The sound design and the special effects throughout celebrate the visceral experience of what it would be like to be intimate with such a creature in slimy, squishy detail. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
The film is a feminist fantasy that lets its protagonist be unlikable, violent, and impulsive, the kind of traits countless male protagonists are afforded. The lure delights in the entirety of the female experience through the exploration of one of the ultimate symbols of mythic female power, the mermaid. And its siren song is absolutely bewitching. So there you go.
I found this bit from director Agnieszka Smysinska, who called the film a coming-of-age story, echoing her own youth. She recalled that her mother ran a nightclub where she had her first shot of vodka, first cigarette, first sexual disappointment, and first important feeling for a boy. The mermaids were an abstraction that allowed her to tell her story without revealing too much of herself. And I did see there was a co-screenwriter, Robert Balesto, who wanted to write a story based on two friends of his that frequented nightclubs in the 1980s. That's why I'm pretty sure, other than the setting, it is the 80s, which resonated with that childhood the director wanted to portray. She also wanted the film to be a retelling of The Little Mermaid, and developed her idea of mermaids from tales of the 14th to 16th century that described them as the sisters of dragons and hence made them part monstrous. She invented their need to feed on human hearts, of which there is a lot of in this movie, and the propensity to attack the larynx of their victims.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Likened the mermaids to immigrants abused by the locals used in the sex industry on the way to their real goal, America, which they mentioned in the movie.
Yeah.
You want to stop here on our way to America? She added they represent innocence, yet their odor and slime recalled girls maturing. They menstruate, they ovulate, their bodies start smelling and feeling different. IndieWire journalist noted that the mermaids' bodies are a source of constant fascination, and the lure is having some fun with chauvinist objectification.
Now, there's a lot to unpack with this movie, and I'm not sure exactly what to make of it. I watched it with Rachel, but afterwards we both looked at each other and like, what did we just watch? What was this all about?
Yeah.
And I mean, did you watch it with Heather?
No, I watched it by myself, and I watched it in like three settings because I have to admit it was challenging to watch. I watched the first hour, and then I watched the first hour, and then a half hour apiece to finish it out. Or it's like a 90-minute movie. However you want to break that out. It's fascinating radio I'm doing right now. But hey, I'm just saying that this is not a movie that you would recommend for all audiences. But if you want something strange or something, you know, challenging, this is one for you. But it's an odd movie.
I couldn't help but think of Splash, the Daryl Hannah, Tom Hanks movie, because I grew up watching that thing. It was on HBO all the time when we had it. So I've watched it over and over again. Had many elaborate fantasies about me meeting a mermaid and going off to live in the underwater kingdom. Yeah, when I was a kid. I thought, very into that movie. That's got John Candy in there too, and Eugene Levy's the bad guy of that movie.
Oh my god, I forgot that.
He's the one that exposes her, because he's like a mermaid hunter, and he throws water on her and she turns into a mermaid hunter, and the government captures her, and then they have to break her out of the facility. That's what that whole thing. So that is like the polar opposite of this movie, where it is sort of an objectification of women, and she offers this freedom to a male character. You know, she has this whole other world where he can be and be free, and he's not stuck in his 9-to-5 job. And that's how the movie ends as well, is they go off and live, because when he's with her, he could breathe underwater as well. And then yeah. they're able to go off to that undersea kingdom. And that's just where the movie ends.
Hmm. Certainly any kind of mermaid tale seems to be exploring how we change ourselves to live in other cultures or societies.
And now, just speaking of mermaids, it's mostly the Greek siren myth that got kind of changed into mermaids. Even though sirens originally were depicted as human-headed birds, but then, you know, because the Greek culture had been around for over 1,000 years, so there's obviously changes within that culture. Later, they became part fish in Greek art. You would see them represented that way. But around 1000 BC, the Syrian god Atargatis, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, she took the form of a fish, but since she was so beautiful, she wasn't allowed to not let her beauty be shown, so only the lower half of her body was a fish. So that's like
kind of like how they always make the masks come off in the Marvel movies, you know?
All right.
Same thing. I'm not paying for Tobey Maguire and then have him wear a mask the whole time.
Yeah,
figure exactly. a way to burn them off of his face, similarly.
Uh-huh. Now, during the Middle Ages in Europe, the siren mermaid transition kind of became much more cemented. It was in the, this is Latin, Piper, can you pronounce this for me? Liber Monstronum De Diversis?
Yeah, Liber Monstrorum. We've talked about that before. Yeah, oh, there's more. De Diversis Genet. No, I can't.
That's from an 8th century, and it described sea girls as top half women, lower half fish, whose beauty and song would lure men to their death. So that's like
sea girls.
Sea girls, they called them. And of course, the mermaid myth is prevalent throughout so many different cultures all over the world. There are mermaid myths in China, Japan, India, Southeast Asia, Africa. There are Arabian myths. Even in the Americas, we've got myths. It's just a very universal idea. I'm not sure why. It's such a bizarre thing, but yet it's in all these cultures. It's this idea of this right. other that's half, I guess, because maybe the water is such an alien world to us. We can't live in it.
That's the first thing. I think that the water is the first alien world that you come into contact with. So, and we're surrounded by it. It's most of the planet. And we are evolved from the stinking slime that crawled out of the water. So I think maybe there's some evolutionary predisposition to be interested in, you know.
Yeah.
I'm attracted to fish. I don't know. Sometimes I see a sexy fish. I'm like, hey. No, that doesn't happen. Wasn't that Troy McClure's thing, though, on The Simpsons?
Yeah.
Well, in the realm of oceans and bodies of water, this movie Atlantics that I watched, it's on... Mm. By the way, The Lure is available, I believe, on HBO Max here, but in the UK, you watched it on Netflix, right?
It's on Netflix in the UK, yeah.
I don't know if this one is available there as well, but on Netflix here, we have the movie Atlantics. I highly recommend this one. It's a really slow burn indie film. And I found this from the Portalist article, 20 Great Sci-Fi Movies Directed by Women. That's where I found the lure as well. Mm-hmm. Mattie Diop was the first black woman to direct a film featured in a competition at the Cannes Film Festival. And this movie, Atlantics, went on to win the Grand Prix there. The film is set in the suburbs of Dakar, Senegal, which is a West African coastal place I don't know anything about. So it was fascinating just off the bat because it's a culture I haven't seen any films from that part of the world. There's this futuristic building dominating the landscape, this giant tower that reminds me a lot of those huge skyscrapers that they build in the Middle East. I'm reading the synopsis here. A young woman and her lover who worked on construction of this building try to find peace together while he sets sail for a better life and she is betrothed to another man. Whatever expectations you have for Atlantics, dispose of them now because it subverts all of them. Imagine a political drama combined with a romance, sci-fi, and ghost story, and you're halfway there. It's a film that feels startlingly original and signals the arrival of a brilliant new director who's only just begun to show what she's capable of. I agree. I don't know what she's working on next, but I'll watch it. The movie was just really great, a great viewing. Science fiction, I'm not too sure about that. It was a lot more of a traditional ghost story in that, okay, so the men who worked on the building And this happens a lot in that part of the world where they have been working for 3 months and did not get paid. They're the people who run the site. Oh, we don't have your money for this reason or that reason. You know, it's just like the beginning of the Treasure Sierra Madre when Bogart's trying to find some money and the guy gets him to go work for a couple of weeks and then skips town and doesn't pay him. It's very similar kind of setup. And so this construction worker and his buddies make a decision to get on a raft, basically, and sail up to Spain.
Wow.
There's all of these women in town who are their girlfriends who greet this news very sadly that that boat capsizes, but then the men come back in kind of an interesting way and in a very creepy and scary way. So it's got a little bit of John Carpenter's The Fog involved in it as well. So I highly recommend this film. I don't want to give too much more of it away. It's slow. It's atmospheric. It's moody.
Yeah.
You like that kind of thing, you're going to like that. Now, there were bathtubs and there were music in The Lure, and that made me think of another movie that we've both watched recently that I very much enjoy, which is called Bathtubs Over Broadway.
Yes.
Friend of the show, Dave Stinton, who's been a reader and opened for us in Chicago at our live show, he recommended the movie to me. It took me like a year to finally look it up and watch it. But this movie is about industrial musicals, which were musicals that were created by big corporations like Ford, for like shareholder meetings, or you know, the whole sales force would come to New York and they'd show them a big Broadway show, but it would be about their products and their sales goals and that kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah. That's why the movie's called Bathtubs Over Broadway, is because there was a whole musical about bathroom stuff, like bathtubs and showers and sinks and all of these things. And there's a lot of them. There was this whole secret subculture of these for, like, they started in the 50s and went up until like the 80s. Every year they would get made, and people, real Broadway people, worked on these things because it was fat cash, like a lot of money. They paid more. I think they said the budget for your typical Broadway play was around $300,000 at the time, and they paid $3 million. So like 10 times the budget at the time. And you know, everybody would work on these things. So you would have stars in them, but they would never go out anywhere. And the only records of them were either videotaped that the company did, or they had actual printed record, like LPs, that they gave out to the people that worked for the company. And that was it. They were never allowed outwards, but there's these collectors that find these things. And some of the songs are really good and catchy, as you would expect, because they're written by real writers and musicians and stuff. And it just goes on this guy's exploration of like trying to track down these things, find out if there's anybody that's still alive that worked on them, talk to them about it, talk, you know, just get their insight in it. And it's just very warm-hearted. The whole thing's really positive and just sweet. And it's a good departure from a lot of the darker things that I watch. Just kind of a fun optimism about the whole thing that I really liked.
Absolutely. That's a great synopsis of it. The guy who is the impetus behind it. Oh, by the way, this movie is also directed by a woman.
Oh,
I would have talked about it anyway, but I looked up the director, and it's Deva Wissanant is her first documentary feature. It's a fantastic movie because it starts being, the main guy in it is a writer for Late Night with David Letterman, the late show with David Letterman. Who they used to do a segment on Letterman that I used to love when I was a kid, where they would find weird, obscure albums that really sucked and they would play, you know, or a B movie sucked, you know, where you enjoyed them. And they'd play selections from each of them. Letterman would hold up the sleeve and they'd play it. And I remember that's the first time I heard Sylvester Stallone's soundtrack for Paradise Alley, which was a movie he was in. And just laughing so hard, Paradise Alley! Anyway, he found one of these movies as part of that segment, and I think it was Here Come the Bathtubs or something like those lines, and then got obsessed. And there's other collectors you meet. Jello Biafra is one of them who collects these albums, the singer for the Dead Kennedys. But it has this interesting switch about midway through where it starts really being about subculture. So it doesn't really matter what the thing is that you're into. The thing is that these people sweated and worked, met their spouses on the sets of these things. And it really meant a lot to them to have somebody outside of that world enjoy it and treasure it and try to keep record of it. And so by the end of it, I think that's why I thought it was relative to this, where we're such a niche operation here. But it did make you feel like, you know what? It is valuable, even if it's such a specific thing as the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. there are people, you know, there's a world for it, and there's a lot of worth to be had in that. And that's really what I thought that this, at the end of the day, was exploring. It elevated its themes a little bit from, because it, when you pitch this movie to somebody, you go, oh, it's such an odd thing that this was for 30 years, these corporate musicals.
Yeah.
And then it transcended that just oddity of it into being a real kind of interesting human story. So I recommend that anybody who likes human stories go ahead and check out Bathtubs Over Broadway. If you like mermaid stories, check out The Lure. And if you like a good classic ghost story, please check out Atlantics. That's what we've got there to say for this extra credit episode.
We went a little crazy on this. We got a lot of content. There's a lot to talk about here. So hopefully you guys stuck with us this whole time. And if not, I don't blame you.
Okay. I don't blame you for jumping ship. Well, that's all we have, mercifully, on this extra credit episode. Thanks so much to our patrons and our matrons for helping us out, tuning in. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Extra Credit on Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.